We're exploring voter rights and voter suppression through history. It's an hour-long conversation on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Access to the ballot box in America, it's a right that has ebbed and flowed, eras of progress during the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and then cycles of setbacks that have eroded voter equality and trust in the institution. And here in Wisconsin, elections officials and political parties are pushing absentee voting ahead of the April 7th presidential preference primary. And today is the last day for voter registration by mail or online for the April election. Are you registered to vote? Where did you go to get registered? How would you describe the process? What do you want to know about the history of voter policy and court challenges through time? We're at 800-642-1234. Gilda Daniels is an associate professor of law at the University of Baltimore. She's been a civil rights attorney for almost 30 years, and her new book is called Uncounted: The Crisis of Voter Suppression in America. Gilda, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, and good morning.
So in the wake of this pandemic, some states like Louisiana and Georgia have both postponed or canceled in-person elections. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, first of all, we certainly want all of your listeners to make sure that they are safe and follow the directions, certainly of the CDC and other medical professionals. We had a few elections on yesterday. The state of Florida held its presidential preference primary, and I am also the director of litigation at Advance for Project, which is a national civil rights organization, and we actually filed a lawsuit and sought a temporary restraining order so that we could expand voting rights and actually extend the dates for vote by mail, because we, in response to COVID-19. To allow people the opportunity to request a vote by mail on election day, and then to submit it to submit those ballots 10 days later, which would be by March 27th, because we felt that in-person voting, for some people, we learned from our partner organizations on the ground that there were people who were not who had medical issues, and there were students who have been told to leave the campus, mm-hmm. right? And we have students who were, you know, may have been students in Florida, but live in New York and live in North Carolina. So we had persons who were unable to vote in person, right?
And this suit you filed in Florida.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we filed it in Florida.
How do you think the COVID-19 will be affecting voter turnout? Wisconsin has a primary April 7th, and right now it's forging ahead.
Right. So in Wisconsin, I think a lot of people are taking advantage of absentee voting and taking advantage of early voting to ensure that they can actually cast a ballot as opposed to waiting for election day. So I think having a number of ways in which people can cast ballots is the way, certainly, to address COVID-19 and also to address other issues of voting and certainly of voter suppression. So certainly early voting in Wisconsin, you have same-day voter registration, which is also helpful in that if you hadn't registered, you can actually go to the polls on an election day and register and vote on the same day. So having all of those measures will be very helpful.
Another complication adding to the situation, we're hearing that some polling locations may need to be moved due to public health concerns because our schools are closed, meaning the city would need to relocate, in Madison at least, a third of its polling sites. You know, what type of issues does that cause?
That has caused a number of issues. Well, we've seen a number of polling place closures, certainly since the Shelby County versus Holder decision, which essentially eliminated some key provisions of the Voting Rights Act. And we've seen in some jurisdictions that were previously required to submit voting changes like polling place closures before they could close them, have been closing polling places, moving polling places, and doing other things without that federal oversight. And so in Wisconsin, closing polling places causes, in other parts of the country, it causes a number of problems in that we're finding that election officials aren't providing voters with adequate notice that these polling places are being changed, and where is the new polling place? Right, and so being notified that A, your polling place has changed, and B, okay, this will be the new site, and often that new site is farther away. There may not, there haven't been considerations such as is mass transit allowed or provided for those sites. So all of those things that are should be considerations to ensure that people continue to have access to the ballot box. And certainly with COVID-19 is one example of people, of election officials having to move polling places, but we're seeing certainly across the country that folk are closing polling places, and particularly in the South, closing polling places in Black and Brown communities and making it much more difficult for those voters to get to the polls.
We're talking with Gilda Daniels, an associate professor of law at the University of Baltimore. Her new book is called Uncounted, The Crisis of Voter Suppression in America. You can join in the conversation at any point. What is your voting ritual like? Do you prefer to cast an absentee ballot or go to the polls? Why or why not? Will you be voting in the spring election in April? And will it be absentee? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Gilda, let's take a closer look at suppression. You write about modern forms of voter suppression, and we're seeing a bit of those even coming out inadvertently around COVID-19. Can you give us some examples of what voter suppression looks like today?
What voter suppression looks like today. Can I talk about what voter suppression looks like today, I think we also have to talk about, kind of link it to history, which is one of the things I do in the book. I think it's important to connect the dots between what's happened historically and then what's happening today. People are familiar with literacy tests. There was a time in our history when you had to pass a literacy test in certain jurisdictions in certain states before you could cast a ballot. And in places like Alabama, where Myra Pless Jones was a wife and a graduate of South Carolina State University and Michigan State University, and lived and moved to Montgomery, Alabama, where she was married and had children, and she's African American. She went to register in the 1950s and was given a literacy test, and the test was how many bubbles are in a bar of soap. Mm. Her response was probably 100. Their response was, you have failed the test. Right? So those kinds of tests were given, just arbitrary questions, how many bubbles in a bar of soap, how many beans in a jar, recite the state constitution, name all the, you know, judges in the, you know, the, all those kinds of things were, and sorts of things were asked.
Voting rights attorney Gilda Daniels is our guide through history. Her new book is called Uncounted. Did you move recently? Maybe you've had to re-register to vote after receiving a notice in the mail. What was the process like? Where did you go to obtain a valid photo ID? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about access to the ballot box and how voter suppression has worked in cycles over the past century, from efforts to eliminate African-American voters from the rolls to new laws that hinder access for a growing minority population. We trace it with author Gilda Daniels, who uses her own grandmother's lifespan to move us through a century of voter fights, as she calls them. What do you think about Wisconsin continuing to forge ahead with the April 7th primary? Have you ever been afraid to vote or have been turned away at the polls? What happened? Be part of this 800-642-1234 email ideas at WPR.org. And University of Baltimore law professor Gilda Daniels stays with us. Her new book is Uncounted. So, Gilda, you decided to look at voter disenfranchisement through the lens of your grandmother, who lived nearly 100 years. Why did you make this decision?
Well, I found that there are cycles in voting and that span about 100, but I see they span about 100 years, right, from the founding of our country to the passage of the Civil War Amendments is about 100 years. From the Civil War Amendments to the Voting Rights Act is about 100 years. And so, and then speaking with my grandmother, who lived to be 99 years old, when I was writing the book, I was just like, wait a minute. So you've lived almost 100 years.
You've lived this history. Yeah.
Right. So it was, certainly was blessed to have my grandmother for a very long time. And so in looking at voting rights through her life, for example, she was born in 1919, right, which was the year that states started ratifying the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. And this year we celebrate 100 years of that ratification that occurred in 1920. So women gained the right to vote in 1920, and she was born in 1919. She should have been allowed to vote in the 1940s. However, the first time she voted was in the 1960s.
What happened?
After the passage of the Voting Rights Act, because she was African American and lived in Louisiana, and the laws prohibited, essentially, right? We had grandfather clauses, poll taxes. You had all types of disenfranchising laws, that, including fear, economic terrorism. People would lose their jobs for voting. And certainly, when I would speak to her about, I asked her, why didn't people vote why was the first time you voted in the 1960s? And she said, black people didn't vote. It wasn't because black people did not want to vote. It was because you had all of these tools that were passed and implemented, certainly over almost a 100-year period, that essentially blocked the ballot box.
Gilda, what did the Voting Rights Act do that previous amendments to the Constitution, ensuring equal rights, could not do?
Well, we know that the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which is what I refer to as, and it is referred to as the Civil War Amendments, certainly provided widespread enfranchisement to black men, right? The 15th Amendment gave black men the right to vote. And we saw essentially the complexion of the government on the state, local, and federal level change. In the 1890s, Mississippi elected two African Americans to the United States Senate. We haven't had two African Americans in the United States Senate from the South since 1890.
Mm.
And we've only had three African Americans in the United States Senate for the last 10 years, right, with Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, and Tim Scott. But so we had widespread elections of African Americans from a short period from like 1890s to 1900s. To 1901, when we then had constitutional conventions in the South that had as their premise to eliminate all of the newly enfranchised black voters. And they did that, it eliminated them in large part by by passing laws that made poll taxes, grandfather clauses, literacy tests, and even felon disenfranchisement as tools for elimination. It was very effective in states like Alabama. In 1890, you had more than 140,000 black men who were registered to vote. By 1908, you had 46.
Oh, wow. So,
those
suppression devices, as you mentioned, the grandfather clauses and those literacy tests and those poll taxes were certainly taking an impact.
Absolutely.
We're talking with Gilda Daniels, who served as a deputy chief in the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division voting section in both the Clinton and Bush administrations. Her new book is called Uncounted. Are you registered to vote? Where did you go to get registered? And how would you describe the process? What is voting like today in America? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Gilda, let's look more closely at Selma, Alabama. What is the significance of Selma in terms of voting rights? What did you see there?
Well, so moving from the Constitutional Convention in the early 1900s, like 1901, when those disenfranchising mechanisms were implemented and had the widespread impact of eliminating black men from the polls, you have almost 100 years, well, certainly from the passage of the 15th Amendment to Selma, right, in 1965. So Selma certainly served, could be held as the birthplace of civil rights because of it had an egregious history of, you know, not allowing African Americans to register, but we just celebrated the 55th anniversary of Bloody Sunday and the march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, in 1965, where Representative John Lewis and others attempted to, you know, cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge to highlight the voting rights issues, not only in Alabama but throughout the South. Where they were beaten and bludgeoned, but after Bloody Sunday, President Lyndon Baines Johnson and the Congress passed the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So after seeing what happened on Bloody Sunday, they were moved to pass the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and certainly that came after years, decades of work. In fact, in the 1950s, Dr. King, in his Give Us the Ballot speech, was talking about the number of the ways in which blacks were, he called them conniving methods, that were being used. But in 1965, with the passage of the Selma, certainly helped lead to the passage of the Voting Rights Act, which again changed the way we can access the ballot by removing the barriers such as the grandfather clauses and certainly there was litigation for those issues, but certainly removing these mechanisms that prohibited people like my grandmother from registering and from casting ballots.
You also call Shelby County the resting place of the Voting Rights Act. What effect did Shelby County have on the 2016 election?
Well, in Shelby County is the city, I'm sorry, the place where, if I said if Selma was the birthplace, then Shelby County might serve as the resting place, in that it was the Shelby County versus Holder decision that led to the gutting of primary provisions of the Voting Rights Act, and the primary provision being the one that required jurisdictions that had literacy tests, grandfather clauses, and other devices to get pre-clearance or get approval from the federal government before they can implement changes. So not having that has certainly impacted voting rights. In any year, the federal government would receive about 5,000 submissions from these jurisdictions, and those 5,000 submissions contain approximately 15,000 changes. And the government would get notice of those changes before they occurred. Now, without without Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and since the Shelby County decision, the federal government does not have an opportunity to vet those changes. And so those changes are just are happening without any federal
oversight.
Yes.
Without weighing in. Talking with civil rights attorney Gilda Daniels as our guide, we're looking at voting through history, hard-fought battles over voting rights, landmark civil rights decisions, and what the present-day suppression looks like. With your comments along the way, what is your grandmother's history with casting a vote? Did she tell you her story of the women's suffrage movement? Share it, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back with Gilda Daniels right after this news update here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And just a quick programming note here. Join us today at 1 for a live national call-in special on COVID-19. Minnesota Public Radio host Carrie Miller will be joined by medical and public health experts to discuss what we know about the virus. And listeners from all over the country can call in. So be part of the conversation this afternoon at 1 here on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're looking at the cycles of voter suppression. Borrowing a line from her grandfather, civil rights attorney Gilda Daniels says, "We're sleeping at a dangerous time. Americans are unaware just how democracy is being eroded bit by bit." Do you vote every election, or did you sit out recent cycles? What do you want to know about the Voting Rights Act and recent court cases? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Gilda Daniels was a senior official in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department in both the Clinton and Bush administrations, and her new book is called Uncounted: The Crisis of Voter Suppression in America. Let's take a call now. Tom is joining us from Oshkosh this morning. Hi, Tom. Hi there, Tom.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My question has to do with your guest's either involvement with people or her own activities in bringing about the vote for black women, which didn't occur until the 1960s.
And what specifically, in terms of her involvement, what do you want to know?
I'd like to know what was the resistance and what were the attempts to keeping that from happening.
Tom, thanks. Gilda, can you address that? What was going on then in the 1960s?
I was just born in the 1960s. Let me tell you, with my involvement. I can so in the 1960s, in particular in the South, there was disenfranchisement, widespread voter disenfranchisement, particularly against African Americans, with the many laws and terror, certainly that occurred during that time. For example, in Alabama in March 1965, only 19% of blacks were registered to vote, compared to 69% of whites. So you had like a 50% gap in registration. And in Mississippi, only 6.7% of blacks were registered in 1965, in March 1965, compared to 69% of whites. So it was almost another 60% gap. After the Voting Rights Act, those gaps closed tremendously. And in many states, like Alabama and Mississippi, you have parity of voter registration between whites and blacks. So the Voting Rights Act certainly helped to remove many of the discriminatory devices that were in place, including literacy tests, which we discussed earlier, and allowed eligible folk to register and vote free of discrimination, and in large part because the federal government actually sent what was called federal observers and federal registrars. They sent federal employees to actually register people because in many places the state or counties refused to do so.
They were resisting it.
Yes.
Yeah. fast forward for us to today. Here in Wisconsin, there's been an ongoing debate on whether to remove about 200,000 voters from the rolls. Where did this idea of purging voters from the rolls come from?
Well, it's a part of what is regular list maintenance. So election officials are required to maintain an accurate voter list. And we have list maintenance procedures. And one statute that speaks to list maintenance is the National Voter Registration Act, or what's commonly referred to as the motor voter law. So with list maintenance procedures, you want to remove people who are dead or who are otherwise not eligible. What has been happening recently in large part is people are being removed for not voting, which is actually something that the NVRA said you should not do, is remove people for not voting. So if you haven't voted in some jurisdictions, if you haven't voted in two consecutive federal elections, they can begin the process to remove you from the voter rolls. And they do this by sending you a postcard of some sort that's essentially says, do you still live here? If you don't return that card, then you can be removed. But I get postcards all the time that I don't even pay attention to. So you can imagine the accuracy of that process is certainly in question and tends to remove people who are otherwise eligible for not voting. And in some instances, you have removal processes that are not accurate depending on what list people are using to remove people from. So we have accuracy issues with these purges, as well as folk being removed for not voting in.
And a lot is resting on that single postcard getting to the proper person and that person reading it. How does removing voters from the rolls affect African Americans disproportionately?
Well, we've certainly seeing that there is a disproportionate effect. Even if you look at the lawsuit in Wisconsin, it was focused on predominantly Black and brown communities. It wasn't a suit that was against the entire state of Wisconsin, but focused on a jurisdiction that had a large Black and brown or communities, and certainly large groups of minority voters or voters of color. So those kinds of directed lawsuits and directed purges tend to impact people of color more so, and we've certainly seen that in other jurisdictions as well. We saw in Georgia, where the state implemented exact match laws, that there were approximately 53,000 people were impacted by that, and most of them were people of color. An exact match meaning that your voter registration application and had to exactly match state records. And with finding that so if you had a hyphen that was missing in your name, your voter registration would be thrown out. In Georgia during the 2018 gubernatorial election, around 53,000 people were said to been impacted in that exact match, and the governor won, the now governor won the election by 55,000 votes.
We're talking with Gilda Daniels. She's an expert on voting rights and a law professor at University of Baltimore. We're looking at the history of voting in America. Where did you go to obtain a valid photo ID? Did you have any difficulties filling the proper documents? What was the result? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Gilda, let's look more closely now at the passing of voter ID laws in states. What do these voter ID laws do?
Well, voter ID laws, essentially, there are different types of voter ID laws, and the ones voter ID laws are they have different types. One, the ones that are the most problematic are restrictive voter ID laws, which say that you can only bring in these very few types of photogenic identification. It's generally a driver's license, military ID, or a passport. The problem with those types of ID and limiting voter ID to those very few types of identification are that many Americans and certainly many citizens don't have those types of identification. In Georgia, when they first tried to implement the voter ID law, 25% of African Americans did not own a car. Mm. And so if you don't have a car, you probably don't have a driver's license. Right? But saying that you had to have a driver's license, military ID, passport, essentially could eliminate 25% of the population from actually having the right to vote. There are many different ways that you can determine whether someone is who, in fact, they say that they are, right? And so you can allow for signature match your signature. You can just have an address verification. Bring something with your address, a gas bill, electric bill, some other piece of correspondence, right? That says this is where you live, this is your address, as opposed to only limiting it to two or three forms of identification.
And you tell the story of Miss Betty Jones, the mm-hmm. Brookfield resident who struggled to get correct information because she didn't have a birth certificate. Right. How are these laws affecting older Americans?
Well, certainly if you're in the book, certainly Mrs. Jones's story, I think, is exemplary of older Americans, particularly those who, like my grandmother, who did not have a birth certificate. Because in order to get a driver's license, you need some underlying documentation, and in many places, in most places, that's a birth certificate. If you don't have a birth certificate, then you can't get a driver's license, right? So, and the process, what I outline in the book, is the process that certainly Mrs. Jones had to go through to verify her birth so that she could then get what was needed in order for her to have the proper voter ID in Wisconsin.
Very big ordeal there. Talking with Gilda Daniels, her new book is called Uncounted. It charts the 100-year fight against voter suppression in America. Your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're spending the hour looking at voter disenfranchisement in America and these cycles from our nation's founding fathers to present day. Author Gilda Daniels looks at this through the lens of her own African-American ancestors in Louisiana and especially her grandmother's life of nearly a century, 99 years. What is your story about voting rights and access to the ballot box? How do you think America can protect the right to vote? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. And Gilda Daniels' new book is called Uncounted, and she stays with us. Let's take a call now. Tom is joining us from Madison this morning. Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Oh, my question is how do we come to the conclusion that some of these voting registration laws are targeting the minority groups when they apply to all the citizens across the board? Everyone needs the same documentation, whether it's birth certificate, social security card, driver's license, etc. And if you don't have those documentations, you go to the website and they clearly tell you how to get, say, a replacement birth certificate, for instance.
Tom, thanks for the question. Gilda, how would you answer that?
Well, we found in places like North Carolina that in North Carolina they actually looked at what ways what would stand as a barrier for black and brown communities to actually cast ballots. And so they removed things. So they made voter ID more restrictive just because looking at the underlying, the cost of the underlying documents, right, and saying and looking and determining that it would be harder for certain communities to obtain those documents. And although these laws might appear to be neutral, they aren't applied in that way that they do impact. We've certainly found that they do impact certain communities more so than others.
What would voter equity look like, Gilda? What would you change?
If I had the ability to change the way that we vote, I would allow citizens of the United States to cast ballots, right? So that they could have a voice in how we are represented. So we have all of these restrictions on how to register and then how to cast a ballot, right? So we put restrictions on. We certainly know there's an age restriction. You have to be 18. And have to be an American citizen, naturalized or born in the United States. And then we have residential requirements. We have time periods in which you can have to register or in most places or you're not allowed to cast a ballot. So things that Wisconsin is doing, I would certainly implement in the rest of the country and have as many ways in which people can register and vote, certainly to increase the opportunities, as opposed to having the many restrictions that we have on voting that certainly range from state to state and in some places county to county.
In the last few seconds we have with you, what can states do to increase voter turnout, to get more people to the polls?
Well, I think, again, increasing the ways in which people can register and the places in which people can register, as well as how they can actually cast a ballot with same-day voter registration, early voting, and other ways that people that you can access the ballot, and educating as well as informing people of what the process is, I think would be very helpful, because we don't have enough information out there about what the process is, because the process is different for every jurisdiction.
Gilda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Gilda Daniels' new book is called Uncounted, The Crisis of Voter Suppression in America. She's an associate professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law. The Wisconsin Elections Commission is reminding voters that all online and mail-in deadline for voter registration is today. And if voters do not register online or by mail today, you can still register in person at your local municipal clerk's office. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about envy.
For those of you who use a wood-burning stove to heat your home during the winter, you understand the never-ending task of keeping wood burning and your pile stacked. Chris Hardy writes about the feelings he has about other people's wood piles during these cold months.
The airwaves are always bombarded with commercials touting the latest and greatest pharmaceutical offerings, but I have one malady for which no drug can cure. You never know when it's going to strike. I'll be driving down the road watching the scenery, and bam! I'm instantly overcome with jealousy and covetousness, and almost a feeling of resentment towards someone I've probably never met. I confess that I have woodpile envy, and I'm particularly attracted to very large woodpiles, no doubt because I'm ashamed at the size of my own. It seems that no matter what I do, my cordwood simply doesn't cut it. For as long as we've lived in the country, we've burned wood as our primary source of heat. And it's not that I don't work at it. It seems like I'm cutting wood all the time. The chances of me cutting a full heating season of wood a year in advance are the same as swine developing winged flight or Lucifer strapping on a pair of ice skates. Properly seasoned firewood should have at least a summer of heat to dry, preferably a year. When that's not an option, I look all winter for dead trees to cut, because they are partially dry, even if it means walking through waist-deep snow. For many years, we burned wood inside, but now we have a wood-fired outdoor boiler, which heats water that is piped into the house. All the fire risk and mess stays outside. It's also the perfect stove for woodcutting procrastinators, as it burns any sort of wood. Wet, dry, old, ugly, if it fits in the stove, it burns. The stove, which heats two homes and the milk house on our old dairy barn, holds 1,000 gallons of water and has a firebox that is 4 feet long, 28 inches high, and 32 inches wide. One of the advantages of having a large firebox is that I usually cut and split the pieces only to the size that is necessary for me to lift them. Sometimes I overestimate my strength, and those end up smoldering away in the front of the firebox because that's as far as I can toss them. The stove is a firewood nympho, always hungry for more. I've never really figured out how much, only that it's at least 1.5 pickup loads a week, more when it's bitterly cold and less during the shoulder seasons. But just how much does it need? Well, let's do the math. The average wood burning season is about 6 months, every day from November through March, and at least half of October and April. The wood stove requires at least 3 fills a day during the colder months. The math tells us that the firebox holds about 25 cubic feet. No one ever stuffs the firebox completely full. So accounting for airspace and ash buildup, let's say it gets filled with 37.5 cubic feet of wood a day. A cord is the standard of measurement for a pile of wood, 4 feet high, 4 feet wide, and 8 feet long. At 37.5 cubic feet of wood each day, a cord of wood will last only 3.5 days from November through March. That's 35 cords of wood to get through those months. And many years, I'm having to burn wood into May. So, conservatively, I need 41 cords just to get through the heating season. It's hard to achieve, much less maintain, a large wood pile when the demand is so great. Dealing with wood pile dysfunction is difficult, but I'm ecstatic when the fire lasts longer than 4 hours. Michael Clements, a veteran woodcutter and burner who lives near Middle Ridge between La Crosse and Cashton, recently gave me a better idea to help lighten the load, in more ways than one. Never split wood bigger than your wife can handle, he said. I'm not so sure my wife will warm up to that idea.
Chris Hardy is a writer based in Jackson County. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And stay with us next hour when we'll be talking about unemployment benefits in Wisconsin amid concerns over the spread of coronavirus. Have you had your hours cut? Is your employer saying you may be laid off soon? Bring your questions about unemployment insurance at 800-642-1234. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.